This is Radio Superior 1951, a reproduction of actual news events with authentic popular music from the 1950s. This is a true story of our past, so step back with us to another time. We bring you now inside the KUWS radio studios and the Martin and McKenna Show.
This is the voice from the line of 10,000 beautiful lakes. I'm Tim Michaels, filling in for Jack McKenna. It's Wednesday, April 11th, 1951. Lou Martin has the 6 o'clock news. Rapid Ray is in with news from the sporting world. Harriet has community news. We have a big surprise for Harriet. And we've got great music from the Cordettes, Louis Armstrong and Arthur Godfrey.
The Colonel is pacing up and down in the waiting room.
Quick, push your desk against the studio door. Turn out the lights. Maybe he'll think we're not here.
It's pretty hard to hide the radio broadcast we'll be doing by not being here.
So we're doomed. The 6 o'clock news is brought to you by Ford Hopkins Drugs, with regulation softballs for just 59 cents. Good evening, Lou.
Good evening, Tim, and good listeners. Impeachment of President Truman is talked as Congress debates the firing of General Douglas MacArthur. We have several reports, starting from the nation's capital.
This is Washington. Jack Bell here. President Truman fired General Douglas MacArthur today on grounds he failed to support and publicly sought to change the grand strategy of the United Nations war against red aggression in Korea. In a sensational statement released at the White House after days of soul-searching and indecision, the president announced, quote, "With deep regret, I have concluded that General of the Army Douglas MacArthur is unable to give his wholehearted support to the policies of the United States government and of the United Nations," unquote. Acting with lightning speed, the president relieved the 71-year-old MacArthur of his fourfold duties as Supreme Allied Occupation Commander in Japan, United Nations Commander-in-Chief for Korea, United States Commander-in-Chief for the Far East, and Commanding General of the United States Army in the Far East. The president named Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway, Field Commander in Korea, to succeed MacArthur in all these commands. That means Ridgway not only will direct the UN campaign in Korea, but also wind up the Japanese occupation, assuming peace treaty plans go through. The president also issued secret messages exchanged between MacArthur and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The evident aim is to show that MacArthur had scorned Washington directives to clear anything he said on political or military policy with either the state or the Defense Department. His dismissal amounts to reaffirmation by Mr. Truman of United States policies for a strictly limited war in Korea, if possible, and for treating Europe as the ultimately decisive area of contest with Soviet communist power. The secret message file showed MacArthur had been given a general presidential order last December, clamping down on policy statements by all government officials. He had been bluntly reminded of this by Mr. Truman's direction on March 24th, after issuing his bid to the Red Commander in Korea to talk peace as UN forces reached the 38th parallel. Meanwhile, on March 20th, the record showed MacArthur had sent to the House Republican Joe Martin the letter endorsing Martin's idea of using Chinese nationalist troops on Formosa to open a second front against Red China, and adding his own conviction that Asia, rather than Europe, is the critical theater of conflict with world communism. While the Truman administration's feud with MacArthur goes back many months, two events were apparently decisive in bringing on the showdown. One was the general's 38th parallel statement, in which he not only invited red peace talks, but also implied that if they didn't, the United Nations might alter their policy and attack red China. This set tempers rising in allied capitals here and abroad. For not only did the policymakers have no intention of expanding the war, but as the messages now released show, they were planning their own much less belligerent bid for peace. Once MacArthur had spoken, this was scrapped. The second incident was the MacArthur letter to Martin, who leads the president's Republican opposition. He used the letter to attack the president's universal military training bill in the House. That was last Thursday. Almost immediately, Mr. Truman began conferring with Secretary of Defense George C. Marshall, Joint Chiefs of Staff General Omar Bradley, and other advisors on whether he should fire MacArthur, and if so, how. The president is understood to have cautioned in these conferences that if he did that, he would face a political battle of staggering proportions. In D.C., this is Jack Bell.
This is Washington. Lyle C. Wilson, United Press. congressional Republicans, angered by President Truman's firing of General Douglas MacArthur, talked about possible impeachments today. GOP floor leader Senator Weary of Nebraska and Representative Joe Martin of Massachusetts talked to MacArthur by Trans-Pacific telephone. Quoting Congressman Martin, "I am authorized to say that General MacArthur would be delighted to have an invitation to speak to a joint session," end quote. He added that MacArthur can be in Washington in about 3 weeks. Martin got mixed up in telling the House of his telephone talk with MacArthur and referred to him as Senator MacArthur. When the Democrats laughed, Martin added, quote, "he might even be higher later," unquote. In times past, the 71-year-old general has been mentioned as a possible Republican presidential candidate. Before the House met, both Senate and House GOP leaders huddled in Martin's office. Martin says the question of possible impeachments was discussed. Martin was asked about the use of the plural impeachments. "The plural is correct," Martin replied. Asked whether impeachment applied to anyone in particular, Martin says it applies to anyone who has transgressed. The plain implications, however, is that they feel impeachment might be warranted against President Truman, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, and possibly others in the Democratic administration. Impeachment is a trial for removal from office. The House must adopt a resolution of impeachment. The Senate then sits as a court to try the impeachment charges. Georgia Democratic Senator Fred Vinson, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, says the president has his full support. He calls MacArthur's removal long overdue. Explosive reaction among lawmakers include demands that Mac testify before the bar of American public opinion on his view that the fate of Europe hinges on the battle with communism in Asia. This runs directly counter to the Truman administration's efforts to localize the fighting in Korea and avoid all-out war with Red China. Senator Robert Taft says the president made a tragic error. Republican Senator Noland of California calls the decision a forerunner to a Far Eastern Munich. The cabinet member's chief congressional critic, Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, calls MacArthur's removal, quote, "a black day for America and a great day of rejoicing and victory for communism. MacArthur is the last bulwark in the East against communism and for America. To destroy him is treason," unquote. Former President Herbert Hoover says, quote, "this action can bring great tragedy to our country. A strong pillar in our Asian defense has been removed," unquote. Republican Representative Alvin Okonski of Wisconsin says, quote, "without question, this is the greatest tragedy that has ever befallen our nation. This move puts into control of our military strategists like Dean Acheson and the British communist lovers who are trying to maneuver Red China into a dominant role among our family of nations. This move means that any further American casualties in Korea are inexcusable and border on the realm of cold-blooded murder on the part of American leaders," end quote. In Washington, this is Lyle C. Wilson.
This is General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo, Tom Stone speaking. General MacArthur received news of dismissal from all his commands today magnificently without turning of hair. Military Secretary of the United Nations Command Major General Courtney Whitney told newsmen here that MacArthur would have no comment for the time being. Quote, "his soldierly qualities were never more pronounced. This has been his finest hour," unquote. The firing of MacArthur came with the drama and irony which has marked the five-star general's 47 years of military life. His notice came without warning during a luncheon at his home. Throughout a career of three wars and tumultuous peace, Mac has shouldered aside precedent to follow his destiny with meteoric and controversial brilliance. Now, at the apparent end of his career, the 71-year-old general is relieved without public hint of criticism for his military ability. In Tokyo, this is Tom Stone, AP.
This is Russell Brines reporting from MacArthur's headquarters in Japan. From the day in 1903 that he graduated at the top of his West Point class, MacArthur has never been away from military affairs. He retired from the Army in 1937, then spent the next 4 years as a field marshal of the Philippines trying to build the defense force. He returned to active duty in 1941, just before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and has remained in uniform since then. MacArthur was named General of the Army on December 18, 1944. It, like most of his other top appointments, was by a Democratic president. He never wore his medals, but he had them all, including the Congressional Medal of Honor and innumerable foreign decorations. MacArthur liked to think that destiny linked his career with the Orient. His first assignment was as an engineer in the Philippines. His career now ends in the Orient. MacArthur had three careers. The first was distinguished by a spectacular rise to power with his appointment as Chief of Staff in 1930. At age 50, he was the youngest man to hold that office, and he occupied it for a record length, 5 years. Before that, MacArthur had been the youngest superintendent of West Point and the youngest divisional commander in World War I. He conceived the idea of the Rainbow Division and served in it. A black mark to his name was as Chief of Staff. He ordered the Army out against Washington's bonus marchers in 1932. Supporters say he was only obeying orders. The general sank into obscurity after he returned to the Philippines in 1935 as advisor to the Commonwealth government. 2 years later, on his last visit to the continental United States, he married the present Mrs. MacArthur. She has been by his side during most of the thunderous years that followed. MacArthur began a second career at 61 when Japanese imperialism bounced him back to war in the Philippines as commander of U.S. forces in the Far East. There, his first fight was with outnumbered and outgunned troops against a determined Oriental enemy. The heartbreaking retreat into Bataan, the bitter battle for that peninsula and its tadpole guardian, Corregidor, and finally the galling capitulation, these all left scars on MacArthur that were to reappear years later. MacArthur was planning for the invasion of Japan, which he was to command, when the Japanese surrender ended the first major war of Western powers against the Orient. A third career opened for the general as supreme commander for the Allied powers, the political emperor of beaten, floundering Japan. He was 70 when the North Korean struck last June. Always mentally keen and so hardworking, he denied himself holidays, but when combat challenged again, he seemed to lose 10 years and to seek action like an old fire horse. The general was elated by the success of the brilliant Incheon landing last September. The North Korean army came apart, and the war was considered almost over. MacArthur and his officers had thought the Chinese communists would hit during the Incheon landing, or not at all. The Chinese attack was a profound shock. It turned a brilliant victory into a bitter holding war, the end of which is not yet in sight. It was then that MacArthur began to show his pronounced and fatal impatience with the restraints under which he was obliged to fight. It was then he began to demand political decisions and to suggest widening the war. But as he made his statements, his memory must have swirled with recollections of that other bloody peninsula, which means so much to him, Bataan. In Tokyo, this is Russell Bryan.
New York calling. AP foreign analyst DeWitt McKenzie here. Hearst newspapers, including the New York Journal-American, the San Francisco Examiner, the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, and the Detroit Times, published the same editorial, saying, quote, "The abrupt dismissal of General Douglas MacArthur by President Truman is a crushing blow to America, long prepared by the clique of administration officials who seem determined on a course of appeasement toward communist Russia and communist China," unquote. The Chicago Sun-Times wrote, "No American general is bigger than the government of the United States. No American general is bigger than his constitutional commander-in-chief. He was fired because he was insubordinate," end quote. The New York World-Telegram said, quote, "Serving General MacArthur's head up on a platter may temporarily appease the yapping yahoos of the British socialist government, but now that the diplomats and the politicians have taken over the war, what are they going to do with it?" The Washington Star. "It is clear that General MacArthur had consistently and deliberately ignored or circumvented admonitions from his superior to hold his tongue," end quote. Newspapers reported they were swamped with telephone calls, the vast majority backing Mac. Man-in-the-street interviews brought a more even division of public opinion. In the Big Apple, this is DeWitt McKenzie.
Hello, this is Max Jordan on the front lines in the ROK. UN drive into Red Korea ground ahead today as Allied air and artillery barrages wiped out the key Chinese base of Chor Wan on the Western Front, 17 miles north of the border. Yanks, Brit, and Turkish troops scored new gains. On the Central Front, GIs drove along the southern shores of the Huashan Reservoir toward the big dam and power grid. On the east coast, where South Korean troops had thrust about 15 miles north of the border, there were no reports of ground action. Allied ships pounded rail lines and roads. What is key here is that South Korea is virtually free of communist troops. The last major pocket of Reds is holding out west of the Imjin River on the extreme western front, but that toehold is iffy. The western anchor of the Red buildup area of Chorwan was the headquarters of three Chinese Army Corps. Field dispatches say it was completely destroyed. American artillery opened up on it 3 days ago. Along the front lines in Korea, this is Max Jordan.
American construction crews in Turkey are building air bases that will place the Free World's bombers within 1 hour's flying time of the main oil fields of Russia and her satellites, and within 3 hours of Moscow itself. Much of the work is top secret. There are four major airfield construction projects, biggest of which is Adana, one of the best locations in the Mediterranean from the standpoint of supply and natural defense. In the Suez Canal zone itself, the Allies are building underground hangars at airfields from which planes might also bomb Russia in the event of war. Despite being relieved of his command, General MacArthur will continue to draw his full pay and allowances and will be subject to orders of his military superiors until he dies. Officers of five-star rank are never retired. Their salary amounts to $18,761 yearly. KUWS Radio News Time is 6:09. Tim Michael has this message from Ford Hopkins Drugs.
Boy, have we got some great news for you from Ford Hopkins Drugs. And Lou, I think you may be interested in this one. You can conquer constipation forever. That's right. You can get Melcolos laxative for only 98 cents in tablet form. Other great buys, boy, they've got a special on candy special peanuts, 43 cents a pound. And for those of you who like to clean the house, we've got rubber-covered wire dish drainers at only 98 cents, rubber-tipped dustpans at 19 cents, rubber sponge, 19 cents. And for the sports enthusiasts, American Cup golf balls, 55 cents each, or three for $1.59, and American Sandlot League Ball softballs at only 59 cents. And if you like wearing sunglasses, they've got specials on aviation-type sunglasses at only 49 cents each. These are just some of the specials that you can get at Ford Hopkins Drugs at 13th and Tower in Superior.
Private First Class Richard Lindbergh, the son of Mr. and Mrs. George Lindbergh, 1309 Banks Avenue, has been wounded during action in Korea. The 18-year-old Lindbergh is serving with H Company, 5th Regiment of the 1st Marine Division. He was wounded on April the 4th. Before joining the Marines in August of 1950, PFC Lindbergh attended Superior State College and was a graduate of the Gordon High School. Oil installations in the city will not offer any great fire threat. Fire Chief Olaf Sorensen told the Superior and Douglas County Safety Council last night. Hazards are inherent with every industry, Sorensen said, but oil is safe because of the knowledge of the material used. At the Lakehead Pipeline Company, precautions have been made by keeping storage tanks in isolated locations and by keeping tanks a safe distance from each other. Any fire that might occur should be controlled by a mechanical foam injection system of the latest type. Through six pipes, 17,000 gallons of foam a minute can be injected into the tanks. The navigation season at the head of the lakes is underway. Ore is pouring into the holds of the Great Lakes ships. The freighters, which officially opened the season, arrived shortly after midnight. The official time of the arrival of the first freighter, the Princeton, was 12:20 a.m. this morning. Ore from the Great Northern Docks at Eloise began pouring into the holds of the L.W. Hill this morning. Seven or eight more ships are expected to get to the docks before the day is over. Six are expected to arrive tomorrow and seven on Friday. Police continue to investigate the robbery of $107 from the cash register of the Shamrock Tavern, 5825 Tower Avenue. A considerable amount of money was also taken in the form of dimes from the shuffleboard in the tavern. Two Ashland stores were broken into last night. Burglars entered the Piggly Wiggly store at 511 East 2nd Street and the Schiller Shoe Store, 313 West 2nd Street. $30 was taken from Piggly Wiggly, $15 from Schiller's. With favorable weather, golfers may be able to take to the course by the 1st of May. Park Department Carl Anderson says there will be no change in the rates from 1950. For 18 holes, it will cost 85 cents. 9 holes costing 50 cents at the Maggi Golf Course, student rates will be 25 cents. Season tickets are $12.50 for men and $10 for women. Tim?
Hey, no fair. They get all the breaks. They get to tee off closer to the green, and I know for a fact they get more mulligans than men.
And how do you know that?
Well, I overhear them when I'm in the woods looking for my ball. The things women say when you don't think a man is around, you'd be shocked.
Yes, mulligans can be shocking.
Let's check the forecast for this Wednesday evening, April 11th, 1951. I call it the MacArthur forecast because it's going to be chilly, folks. Snow flurries with a low of 30 degrees tonight and a high tomorrow of 38. It's music time. Here's Arthur Godfrey and Blow the Man Down on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Come, all ye young fellers who follow the sea with the way I blow the man down. Pray pay attention and listen to me. Oh, give me some time to blow the man down. 'Twas aboard a black baller I first served me time. With a way I blow the man down. And in that black baller I wasted me prime. Oh, give me some time to blow the man down. Come on, yes, what's the next year? That is when the black ball is preparing for sea. With a way I blow the men down, you'd split your sides laughing the sights you would see. Oh, give me some time to blow the men down at the tinkers and tailors and soldiers and all. With a way I blow the men down who ship for prime seamen aboard a black ball. Oh, give me some time to blow the men down. Fire the pink locker, on deck the fire rescue party. Still a hand in your squad. That is when the black baller is clear off the land. With a way I blow the men down. The bosun then calls out the word of command. Oh, give me some time to blow the men down. Lay up is the cry to the break of the poop. With a way I blow the men down. Or I'll help yous along with the toe of me boot. Oh, give me some time to blow the men down. That is larboard and starboard on the deck you will sprawl. With a way I blow the men down for kicking Jack Williams commands the black ball. Oh, give me some time to blow the men down.
Arthur Godfrey and Blow the Man Down on Station KUWS.
Let's take a pause now for Douglas County Draft Board Chairman, Colonel Joseph P. Raffley.
I'll need to take a pill for that pause.
Cute, real cute.
But you're not my type.
Look, McMickle, nothing can upset the Colonel tonight. He's in a good mood.
Using my veteran newsman experience, I detect an opening here. Why are you in a good mood, Colonel?
This is a good mood?
Darn tootin', the Colonel's downright gay tonight. I've got a letter from a group of draftees we sent to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri a month ago.
You're happy about getting hate mail?
What Tim is trying to say is, you probably don't get a load of Christmas cards from draftees.
Well, this time it's different. Private Lloyd Nielsen writes, and I quote, here it is. All right. 14 of us are at Fort Leonard Wood and are doing fine. I am writing for myself and the 13 other guys because we thought the draft board would be interested to know that we like Army life. We have our first month in and hope and pray to only have 20 days left. I'll tell you right now, it just makes me want to break down and cry, McKinnell.
That last part sounded a little less than enthusiastic.
It did go on to say that they all hate Missouri.
They can't wait to finish, and they hate Missouri, but otherwise everything is great.
All right, look, McMichael, this is a nice letter. Don't take that away from me. This Private Nielsen and Ed McKibben and Norm Sivenson, they like the colonel, and they took the time to, well, they took the time to say so.
You don't get many of these letters very often, I take it.
Well, no.
Once in a while?
Well, no.
Ever?
Well, this is the first. A guy could get some type of Edovitz complex working this job.
I don't think that's right, but thanks, Colonel. For the Colonel, then, here's George Gibbs and Seven Lonely Days on the Martin and... What was I this time?
McMichael.
Right. On the Martin and McMichael Show.
Seven lonely days make one lonely week. Seven lonely nights make one lonely me. Ever since the time you told me we were through. Seven lonely days I cried and cried for you.
Oh, my darling, you're crying. Ooh, 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 ooh. There's no use in denying I cried for you. It was your favorite pastime, making me blue. Last week was the last time I cried for you.
Seven hankies blue are filled with my tears. Seven letters too are filled with my fears. Guess it never pays to make your lover blue. Seven lonely days I cried and cried for you.
And cried for you. Oh, my darling, you're crying.
Seven lonely days make one lonely week. Seven lonely nights make one lonely me.
It was your favorite.
Ever since the time you told me we were through.
Last week was the
seven
last.
Georgia Gibbs and Seven Lonely Days on Station KUWS.
And now, Community Editor Harriet Farig. Lovely hat tonight.
It's a nice combination of feathers, flowers, and fur.
Whatever bird or animal or plant that was, it's extinct.
Never mind, Timothy. As long as Lewis appreciates it. A wonderfully moving event took place today. Superior Bishop, the Most Reverend Albert Meyer, invested the Right Reverend Monsignor William Kubelbeck with the rank of Protonotary Apostoli, highest ranking of Monsignors conferred outside of the Vatican. The Reverend Leo Block served as Deacon of Honor, and the Reverend Alphonse Cress as Master of Ceremony. The service was held this morning at Saints Anthony and Margaret Church, at which Monsignor Kubelbeck is the parish priest. Now, gals, listen up. The Cosmos Bridge Club will hold a special ladies' night next Monday evening. Mr. A.W. Allen and Mr. James Bell extend this generous invitation to all players at the head of the lakes. Coffee and cake will be served in the American Legion clubrooms. Congratulations to the former Miss Elsie Tykela, daughter of Paul Tykela of Maple. Miss Elsie married Sergeant Richard Thorstad, son of Oliver Thorstad of Duluth, last Saturday at Concordia Lutheran Church in Superior. The Reverend Andrew Bow officiated. And this is so exciting. After leaving Sweden in 1893, Mrs. Amanda Jackson of John Avenue will be returning to her homeland for a four-month visit. Mrs. Jackson will sail from New York on the Swedish liner Gripsholm, Lewis.
Returning after 58 years? That is special.
Hey, Miss Farrig, let me show you the letter I got today. It's real nice.
You got a letter?
Yeah, from guys I drafted.
I think he's going to have that letter laminated and framed.
I'm not laminating anything, McGidiot.
Sorry. Here's Louis Armstrong and A Kiss to Build a Dream on the Martin and... What do we call it now?
I won't say what he calls it now.
Okay, the Martin and McGidiot Show.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on. And my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me. And my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. A kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you. Even romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on. Just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Oh, give me what you alone can give. I'll give the field a dream on.
Louis Armstrong and A Kiss to Build a Dream on KUWS. Hiya, Ray.
The Colonel's pretty happy about that letter.
If you look closely, you'll see tear stains on it. Now, Ray Paulson with the sports.
Good evening, fans of the sporting world. That crack catcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers, Roy Campanella, says he can't wait for the 1951 baseball season to get underway. The rotund catcher is playing in mid-season shape right now, hitting two singles and two doubles today as the bums down Class B Carolina League team, Greensboro. Ed Lopat looks like a cinch to pitch the opening game for the New York Yankees next Monday in Washington. The crafty lefty has been consistently good all spring training. Orestes Minimoso now looks like a good bet to take over first base for the Cleveland Indians. The versatile Cuban will fill in for injured Luke Easter on opening day. And the Class D Northern League teams are opening their baseball training camps this week. Eau Claire Bears are at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and the Superior Blues are in Madisonville, Kentucky, under manager Buster Mills. The Duluth Dukes will field some homegrown players this year. They'll feature outfielder Dick Martin, an all-sport athlete from Duluth Cathedral, Bob Walczak, also of Cathedral, and pitcher Joe Tessier from Duluth Denfeld. And Stan the Man Musial might not get his $35,000 pay hike from the St. Louis Cardinals after all. You see, the big boost violates the new government salary controls. Musial may have to limp along with last season's $50,000.
We should pass the hat and help the poor guy out.
Oh, yeah. This is Rapid Ray Paulson reminding you that everyone loves a good sport.
Thanks, Ray. Hey, we have a surprise for Harriet next.
A surprise even for me, and I'm part of this.
But first, let's hear the Cordettes and Born to Be With You on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Born to be with you.
The Cordettes and Born to Be With You on station KUWS.
Okay, Harriet, come on in. We have your surprise for you.
A surprise for little old me?
Little old you and your big hat. What is that thing?
Now, be nice, Colonel. Let's not ruin our big surprise.
Right. It was my idea, Miss Fofog. My nephew goes to East High, and he's been in the band, and I thought I'd go. Because the missus insisted on it, or I'd be eating hot dogs and beans for the next month, which I don't mind, but it sounded tough. And when the Mrs. Colonel Raffley gets that way, you can expect all the joy in all of my already not-too-joyful life to be kind of get sucked away. And I was getting to a point here. Jeez, McMutton, you have absolutely no patience. Well, the missus couldn't make the concert because she's a bit under the weather with her sinuses. The noise she can make with her nose and chest is absolutely unbelievable.
Anyway,
I didn't want to go alone, and frickin' Frack here never seemed to do anything worthwhile, so I thought I'd call them and I'll see if they wanted to come with me.
And then I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we covered this concert? for Harriet.
So here we are.
Well, that's just about the sweetest, nicest thing I ever heard. How thoughtful, Lewis and Colonel.
And Tim. I volunteer too, you know.
I've seen people volunteer more gracefully to go before a firing squad.
Lots of kicking and screaming.
I just kicked. The Colonel did the screaming.
Not that embarrassing high-pitched scream.
That's the one.
So we wrote a review for you together.
May I have the honors?
Certainly.
Indubitably.
Oh, heavens!
Yeah, all right.
Sounds like he's trying to cop up a cat.
Aha, here we go. East High School Band, directed by Gerald Hack, presented an inspired concert before a capacity audience in the East High Auditorium Sunday night.
The band's treatment of melodic Bells of St. Mary's offered an early change of pace, and then Lucy Aronson stepped on the stage to offer a flute solo.
That solo was Visit's minuet de l'Alison, accompanied by Joan Hooker at the piano. The tonal quality by Miss Lucy was most pleasing.
Betty Erickson, Mickey Hodges, and Eugene Brandstrom gave a smooth, rhythmic performance as an accomplished cornet trio to the accompaniment of the band.
Their selection was High Flyers for Johnson.
Tchaikovsky's My Chaste Slave offered another opportunity for the band to reveal the advanced progress it has made during the school year. Especially my nephew. I mean, he stunk before. And now, he's tolerable. He's not too bad, actually, now.
In a different mood and also highly pleasing was the peppy Copacabana by Walters.
The audience liked the interpretive dance Dry Bones, featuring Ann Quam, Barbara Fitzgerald, Marilyn Gagne, and Lillian Leland, trained for the number by Miss Doris Bruner.
And the program was brought to a stirring conclusion by Susan's March, El Capitan. The end.
Did you do that all by yourself?
Amazing, aren't we?
Principal Stephens, help.
That's it, folks. Stay tuned for the great Gildersleeve and NBC Radio Theater. We'll be back same time, same place in your radio dial, the good Lord willing, and Principal Stephens doesn't give us detention for that review. For Lou Martin, Harriet Ray, and the Colonel, this is Tim Michaels sitting in for Jack McKenna, wishing one and all a good night.
It's good you boys were exposed to some culture.
Now, whoa. The Colonel can't be exposed to any culture. Draft boy German can't afford to get sick.
How come Ray didn't go?
He had to cover the fights.
Saved by pugilism.
And I can't be exposed to those germs either.
You've been listening to Radio Superior 1951, an original production by KUWS Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Radio Superior is produced and written by Mike Simonson. Harriet Fahrig is played by Jennifer Simonson. Other performances by Duke Scorridge, Tom Martinson, Joel Anderson, John Munson, and Pat Kelly. All events reported on Radio Superior 1951 are actual accounts from the Superior Evening Telegram. This is your announcer, Mark Snow, speaking. Good night.